Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, writer and researcher Gail Crowther discusses her new book, Dorothy Parker in Hollywood. This program originally took place January 21st, 2025, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everyone, to this online program with the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the Director of Programming here at the museum. Thank you all for joining us here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. Today, we're here to talk about a little remembered chapter in one of this country's great literary lives. Dorothy Parker was a poet, essayist, critic, short story writer, and one of the wits of the New York literary scene in the Roaring Twenties. But she was also a brilliant screenwriter and political activist who fought for the marginalized during the rise of fascism in Europe. She founded unions, defied HUAC, organized her fellow writers for fair wages and credit for their work, and left her entire worldly estate to the NAACP. This Hollywood portion of her life is the subject of Gail Crowther's new book, and she's here with us to talk about it today. Gail is a researcher, writer, and academic. She's the author of Three Martini Afternoons at the Ritz, The Rebellion of Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, The Haunted Reader and Sylvia Plath, and the co-author of Sylvia Plath and Devon, A Year's Turning, and These Ghostly Archives, The Unearthing of Sylvia Plath. Gail divides her time between the north of England and London, where, as I understand it, it's slightly warmer than it is here in Chicago. Welcome, Gail.
Hello.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for inviting me.
Of course. We're really excited to talk about this book today. I finished it over the weekend and it was amazing. And I thought I knew, you know, a lot about Dorothy Parker as a casual fan, but I learned so much reading your book. And I wanted to start by asking, what drew you to Dorothy Parker and this specific period of her life?
I think Dorothy Parker was a woman who really interested me because I feel as a writer and a woman who writes, I'm always very interested in women who I feel have some kind of, I don't quite know what the word is, it's not misunderstood, but maybe unresolved legacy or legacy that isn't perhaps what it could be. And certainly, if you think about writers like Sylvia Plath, who I spent most of my earlier career researching and writing about, you know, she was a woman whose legacy was very problematic. And likewise with Anne Sexton, you know, two women who were almost, you know, the stereotypes around them were very damaging, I think. And when it came to Dorothy Parker, I felt somehow her reputation was, she's very well known for being a wit. She was very well known for the Algonquin Round Table. But I knew that she'd worked in Hollywood, and I was interested why that wasn't a bigger part of her legacy, really. And then when I started thinking about that and looking into it, I couldn't believe the films that she'd worked on, both credited and uncredited. And I thought, there is something here that has to be looked into in a bit more detail, which is what I did. But then, of course, for anyone who's read the book, what began to unravel then was not just her work in the film industry, but her political activism too, which astounded me.
You talk a little bit about in the beginning of the book, as you know, as you're placing her in New York, you know, why she chose to move to Hollywood, because it wasn't something that she dreamed of, right? It wasn't, she had a sort of, you know, adversarial relationship with the idea. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the original title for the book was called Out There, because that's what Dorothy Parker called Hollywood. She referred to it as out there. Is some dreadful plays over on the West Coast that she felt was small townish in comparison to New York, which of course at the time it was. You know, there was still, she was living in a hotel, and the road beyond that was still a dirt road. There were still bean fields around the major hotel. So I think it was quite a shock for her to go from, a metropolitan city like New York to Hollywood. But also, I think she had another feeling that somehow writers were wasting their time out there, that they were wasting their talent, and they were doing it for money, which was her sole reason for going to Hollywood, because she earned vast amounts of money doing that. And so Dorothy Parker, when she spoke about Hollywood, I mean, she was very witty about Hollywood at first, and she was offended by the palm trees. She was offended by the weather. And even if she saw something vaguely promising, she would say, "You can have a wonderful house here. You can have a swimming pool. I don't swim." So, there was always some kind of downside to what Hollywood had to offer. And yet she knew that she could make lots of money if she went there. And so, like lots of writers from the East Coast, that's why she went there.
She had other contemporaries when she did go there. She had, she had friends out there. And so what kind of writer community was developing there at the time?
I think in many ways, quite a lot of members of the Algonquin Roundtable sort of transplanted themselves from Manhattan into a place called the Garden of Allah in Hollywood, which was really quite a spectacular sounding place that had been a mansion of a silent film star who'd lived in Hollywood and had fallen upon hard times. So turned her mansion into a hotel and then built several bungalows in the grounds of her mansion around a swimming pool, which then became the Garden of Allah, which just sounded the wildest place in the world. And so they all congregated in there. And Robert Benchley, who was Dorothy Parker's best friend, had also moved to Hollywood. And I think Martini Hour started at, well, who knows, you want to say kind of 5 o'clock, but I think it was more lunchtime. And so they would be, they had a glass teapot apparently, and they would serve my it would be afternoon tea, and they would serve martinis out of this glass teapot. And so there was this real sort of wild partying and yet intellectual community that developed there. And the Garden of Allah was directly across the road from Schwab's Pharmacy. So they were always just within, 30 seconds distance of topping up their whiskey and their gin and the occasional sandwich if they felt like putting a lining on their stomach too.
I admire their tolerance. Yeah, you mentioned that she felt that writers were wasting their time out there. What contributed to that? What was work like for writers at that time?
I think Parker's main concern, and also something that she really disliked about working in Hollywood, was she felt that writers were very often pitched against each other. She felt that writers were not valued in the same way that they were. For example, if she brought out a volume of her verse, that would be, her verse sold very well. They were best-selling books, and her name was attached to it. And then when she arrived in Hollywood, although they had chased her and wanted her there for a long time, when she turned up, nobody knew who she was. And then she would be given work to do on a film script, and then she would discover that another group of writers were working on it. And she would find that out purely by accident. And then she would discover that the studios had lots of groups of writers all working on the same thing. And then they would just decide, bits and pieces here and there, and or maybe just completely scrap what one group of writers had been working on. So she realized, I think, very early on that the process of writing for films was very different. And sometimes when she first went out there before she was married, she also found sometimes the work process quite lonely. She'd be shoved in an office and just be left there all day. And she disliked the fact that everybody, she disliked a lot of things, but she disliked the fact that she claimed everybody in Hollywood thought they could be a writer. The people who worked on the gates at the studio and let her through the gates were like, "I'm working on a script," and people coming into the offices doing very things, "I'm also writing a film." And so she was just very, "Oh, everybody wants to write." And yet there she was, taken from New York to Hollywood, for her particular skills.
So how did she find her place there? How did she establish herself and become start to get some of that really lucrative work?
I'm not sure that she ever felt established in Hollywood, and I think that she never settled properly in Hollywood. She spent a lot of time there, over 30 years on and off. But when you look at, and however hard I was researching, it was really difficult to keep track of where she was. She was constantly moving around. She was constantly moving house. And sometimes even when she bought a house or rented a house, she would move into a hotel for a while, even though she still had a house. So it's like, where is she now? What's she doing? And when I was looking at her FBI files, and they were also trying to follow her around, not doing a much better job than I did, but they were kind of, oh, right, no, she's here now. And then I'd be researching a part of her life, thinking, right, she's living in this house now. But then the FBI were writing a report on her during that period, and she was somewhere else in the town. So I think in terms of settling, I don't really think she did. And I think she kept popping back to New York. And then she also bought a farm in Pennsylvania too. And so she was sort of triangulating her time between those three places, really.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the political organizing work that she was doing in Hollywood. She started her political journey and her awareness of politics and social issues very young, correct?
And that was when she was very young, and she had a woman who she referred to as a horrible aunt, who had was very much of the mindset that there was a hierarchy in society, and that they were much further up the hierarchy than other people. And Parker never liked that. She never really liked that idea, that it was okay to get other people to. I mean, the example that I'm thinking of is when she was young, she saw some people being forced to scrape the snow from her steps outside of her apartment in New York, and she just felt really uncomfortable about that hierarchy. And so I think that began. But then she got expelled from a school that she was at in New York for being appallingly behaved and bullying her teachers, and just, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's kind of an amusing story. But she got kicked out of there and got sent to a different school, which was very progressive. And there she was introduced to all sorts of different political ways of thinking, and a very liberal way of thinking too, and learning about different political ideologies, communism, things like that. And so that, I think, is when her, so she would have been in her kind of mid to late teens, when I think her political ideologies started to cement themselves in a particular sort of way, which was obviously very left-leaning. And really from there, she didn't get, I don't think she was overtly political in her Algonquin days. And she complained that other people who were part of the Algonquin Roundtable, she felt they were lazy and they didn't care politically about anything, and she got very frustrated about that. So I think she was briefly involved in some activism in Boston, where she was arrested for loitering, which is such a Dorothy Parker thing to be arrested for. And then when she moved to Hollywood, I suspect, much to her surprise, she encountered a group of people who were much more involved in the type of political mindset that she was involved with, and actors like Frederick March and his wife, Florence Eldridge, and Donald Ogden Stewart. So people like that, who they started to form a political group, and that's when they started campaigning for things like better conditions for all writers in Hollywood, because although Dorothy Parker was earning an awful lot of money, at one stage she was earning what would amount to the equivalent today of $20,000 a week for her writing. She was aware that lots of writers were earning next to nothing and were also on kind of what in the UK we would call a 0-hour contract. You don't work, you don't get paid, and you might be pulled in, you might not, but you weren't allowed to take on any other work in case the studio wanted you. And it was really, really difficult. And so she realized that there needed to be some kind of union, there needed to be some kind of screenwriters guild. So she got involved in that, and then, all kinds of other things.
What kinds of films was she working on at this time when she was really in her high earning period? What are some of the films that she worked on, and what kind of work did she do?
Well, when I first started looking into Dorothy Parker, I am really ashamed to say that I had no idea that she had written A Star Is Born, the original Star Is Born. And I'm even more ashamed to say that I thought the first version of A Star Is Born was Judy Garland, and I had no idea there was an earlier one, which maybe says more about my ignorance about Hollywood than, but so I, So the first really big smash hit film that she had w was A Star Is Born, which she co-wrote with her husband, Alan Campbell, and also another writer, Robert Carson. And that was a film that the studio had been trying to make for a long time, and it just wouldn't work. They just couldn't get it to work for whatever reason. And so they brought Parker on board, and as soon as she was on board and writing it, obviously, it was a huge hit. Parker and Campbell and Carson were nominated for an Academy Award. And it was, I think, the perfect vehicle for Parker because she was able to really start to unpack what she saw as the corrosive nature of Hollywood. So basically, everything she hated about Hollywood, she was able to write about. And how she felt it damaged certain people. And so that was the kind of thing that she was working on. But she was also working on much lighter things too. So a film called Trade Winds with Frederick March, a film called Sweethearts with Janet Gaynor. And so there was a much lighter side to it too. And then working on uncredited films as well that. And I'm sure she worked on many uncredited films that we don't know about. So she had a lot of work at first in those early years.
Yeah, you mentioned in your book about the difficulty of researching her because she left so little behind. Where did you find information, and especially new sources of information about her?
It was really difficult. And that was also part of the challenge of writing about her, because as well as being fascinated by this time in Hollywood, I'd just come from writing about Plath and Sexton, who have such extensive archives, everything from childhood through to the end of their lives, just about every manuscript, every single thing that you could possibly want or need or be fascinated by. And then suddenly you're presented with someone who has no paper archive at all, hardly any manuscripts. And when she died, anything that was in her apartment was immediately thrown in the trash. And so hardly any possessions left either, which I just found really tragic. But it was also very fascinating that somebody of her stature, that could happen to her. And so first of all, I looked at what was in existence of hers, which wasn't very much. And so then I had to start looking at secondary sources, so secondary archives. So, for example, I looked at Robert Benchley's archives and, was there anything in there that she, and there was a really beautiful handwritten letter from Parker to Benchley, which was just fabulous too, because again, we don't see many examples of her handwriting. So that was super exciting. Then, so looking at different archives from different people that may have contained things from her or about her. And then I think probably the best find I had was from the University of Michigan, where there was an entire correspondence from Alan Campbell to Dorothy Parker when he had been stationed in Europe in the Second World War. Sadly, the correspondence was one-sided. It was him to her. But what became evident was that he was referring to letters that he'd received from her. So you could kind of tell what she was up to and where she, although again, he struggled to, where are you, Dorothy? Are you in Hollywood? Where in Hollywood are you? Are you in where are you? He didn't even know where his wife was. And so I think that she was very ghostly. She kept flitting into view and then disappearing again. And then I did massive newspaper trawls of the time. So the New York Times, the LA Times, general American newspaper archive searches. And again, that threw up lots of articles about where she was, interviews that she'd given. So that was special, actually getting contemporaneous interviews where you can read her own voice and her own words on things, because again, we don't have many of them. There's not much of them. And then New York Public Library had a recorded interview. So yeah, kind of just picking through things. And then Marion Mead, who'd written a biography on Parker about 35 years ago, she was doing her research when people who knew Parker were still alive. So she had been able to interview people who knew Parker. And so going into her archives and reading her primary research notes.
You alluded to this a little bit earlier, but, you know, she was during her lifetime often very ill and, you know, obviously a very severe alcoholic, and Hollywood was not the best place to keep that sort of thing under control. But she did have those periods of, you know, of extremely hard work and her political activism. And so how did she balance all of these different aspects of her life?
I think there were times when her alcoholism definitely interfered with her ability to do very much at all. And they were very distressing times to research and distressing times to write about. I think in many ways, throughout the 30s and 40s, her marriage to Alan Campbell was a really positive thing to happen, because he was very organized and he acted basically, they loved each other very much, but he was also a great manager for her. And he also took care of her, which I think is really unusual to read for a woman writer. You know, I was talking about this to somebody the other day, and I said, I think the only other example that I could really think of with that level of care was probably Leonard Woolf with Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
But Alan Campbell would do all the cooking. He would do all the cleaning. He would do all the shopping, and he would look after her, and he would be her stylist. He would help her choose clothes. He would suggest hairstyles for her, and he would do all the pay all the bills, do all the business correspondence, and basically get her organized, because she was hopeless at that. You know, she didn't know how to cook. She didn't know how to clean. And so I think she was lucky that he was there to keep things on track, certainly work-wise, and they worked together a lot. So I think her work got done because they would sit in the office together and he would be like, right, Dorothy, now what do they say next? And he would type up and she'd sort of be sitting there swearing and, you know, being badly behaved, and he'd have to get her back on track. And I think when that marriage broke down, that's when things became very difficult and things got very out of control in terms of her drinking. But also, I think the political activism and the writing seemed to be okay together. They seemed to go quite well together, because I think that it was part of the Hollywood circle that she was working in. So the other writers that she was working with, the actors that she was working with, were all, you know, sharing that same ideology. And so I guess it just, you know, their lives were swept up in that. But she was always doing things. She was always on committees. She was always donating vast amounts of money, campaigning, signing manifestos, going to rallies, giving speeches. She was busy.
Yeah. And that work is what led her to gain the attention of the FBI, correct?
Yes.
So what was their interest in her?
I think their interest in her was her very obvious left-leaning sensibilities at a time and in a place at that time where they were very twitchy and edgy, you know, during those McCarthy years when everybody was getting hauled over, hauled in, and spoken to. And of course, she was moving in the circles, and she didn't hide what she was doing. She wasn't secretive about it. You know, that there's debate about was she or wasn't she a member of the Communist Party? She always claimed that she wasn't, and you know, although she had communist sympathies, she claimed she was never a member of the Communist Party, and there's no reason to disbelieve her because she was so brutally honest about everything that, and certainly towards the end of her life, she would have had no reason to lie about that. So I, you know, but I just think, I think the kind of things that she was involved in, I think spending time in Spain during the Civil War there, writing about that. Again, the kind of left-leaning publications that she was writing for all came brought, you know, brought her to the attention of the FBI. But ultimately they decided, you know, she wasn't a threat. But
But
then
she
probably because
didn't.
they couldn't keep track of her.
Which house is she at? She lost her tails
I
unintentionally.
know. She could have been at
Yeah.
communist headquarters and they wouldn't have known.
Yeah. Yeah. But you talked about this a little bit in the book. There's a coherence to her political activism and so much of her writing, which is about the difficulty of being a woman and living a woman's life. And so, she kind of creates that through line of, she's pushing against boundaries and limitations and people being treated unfairly. But a lot of that was reflected in her own work, correct?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that in many ways, I think because Parker is such a well-known figure, certainly in terms of her witticisms and her years at the Algonquin Round Table and in Manhattan, I think that it's sometimes overlooked that she was very much a woman in a man's world. And one of the few women, and this again, I think this is something that she never really gave Hollywood enough credit for. Hollywood was a place where women could earn as much, if not more, than men, one of the very rare places at that time. And she was really one of the top earners in Hollywood because she was so sought after, mainly because of her skill in writing dialogue, which was a direct reflection of the type of short stories and the type of verse that she wrote, which were very much based on her skills of observation. You know, she had a great ear, and then, you know, that would come out in her writing, which I think is what resonated with people. But her experience as a woman in her personal life in her early years, in her 20s, was extremely traumatic and was a direct reflection of how terrible women were treated. That, not that I'm suggesting it's much better now or potentially going to be in the coming years, but you know, the kind of reproductive rights, for example, that were available to somebody like Dorothy Parker when she found herself in a very difficult position and needing an abortion were appalling. And she had a dreadfully traumatic experience in her 20s. Again, similarly with her mental health, you know, just there wasn't really the kind of support network that she needed, and she didn't get it. And so, of course, you see in those early years of Parker's life, we see, you know, several suicide attempts, which you don't kind of equate with Parker's reputation, I think. I think she's seen as, and even after those suicide attempts, you know, people didn't really think that she meant to die. You know, they thought there was something humorous about it, and it's like, is this a woman who swallowed shoe polish? You know, she wasn't messing around here. This was a serious suicide attempt. So all of, you know, that experience of trauma, specifically trauma connected to being a woman and finding her way in a man's world, she was a very, very brave and bold woman, and I really admired and respected her for that.
Yeah, the treatments for her contemporaries, for people that of that era for mental illness, as you said, it was trivialized, it was pushed aside, it was not talked about. But even if it was taken seriously, her options would have been incredibly limited.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I think that I'm speculating here, so I do have to say that I'm speculating. And I know this is, I know people don't like biographers doing that, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I think that, I think the world that she moved in when she was younger, and she has kind of said this as much because she found it frustrating that it wasn't political enough. I think she felt quite often it was too surface level and that everybody just wanted to crack jokes and have a good time. And so when she'd been through a traumatic experience, like having, you know, a really traumatic abortion, and she, like many people who've been through trauma, you have to talk about it. You need to talk about it. There needs to be some kind of outlet and to bear witness to what you've been through. And people were like, oh, shut up, Dorothy. You're always talking about the same thing. Shut up. And so she stopped talking, and that's when she made her first suicide attempt. And so I think that I think you're, yeah, I absolutely agree that there wasn't, that there just wasn't the options for any support there.
Why do you think, you know, it appears several times in, you know, in your book, and especially at the very beginning and the end, why do you think we disregard this period of her life? You know, we think of her in the Algonquin Hotel, we think of her as this, you know, this sort of sharp little poetess who's being, you know, who always had a funny, mostly mean word for someone that she didn't like, you know, but we overlook this whole chapter, and I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on why that was.
I think because it's uncomfortable. I think it's uncomfortable to acknowledge prolonged or difficult periods in people's lives like that. And also, I think it's particularly uncomfortable with somebody who we kind of want to be funny, and we want to have had a nice life, and we want them to have been as joyful as their writing is. And it's really interesting that when Parker came back from Europe, when she'd spent time in Spain and seen the atrocities that were happening in during the Civil War there, and she was writing very serious pieces, and she felt humor was completely inappropriate at that time. And editors were saying, God damn it, Dorothy, why can't you be funny again? You're really boring when you're serious. And I think there's maybe because the world can be a really terrible place. We, you know, we don't want people to have been through difficult times like this. And I have to admit that as her biographer and writing about her, particularly those last years, I was really resistant. And I thought, can I just miss these last years out? Can I just not write about them? Because it's horrible. And they were horrible to research. They were horrible to write about. And in the first draft, I didn't really include much detail. And my editor said, I think we need more here. And I said, but it's not nice. And she said, but that's how it is. And that is how it was.
Yeah, she had a brand as a writer, and her people didn't understand when she started to deviate from that.
I think so, yeah. And also, I think it, to a certain extent, I wanted to respect her. And in so much as you're writing a biography about someone, you also want to, I think there are boundaries about where you will and won't go when someone's had a difficult time. So there were things that I uncovered about Parker that I would never have put in the book, you know, because I respect her too much. And I think she's entitled to dignity and respect from somebody who is actually writing about her. So I think you have to bring some kind of ethical consideration into it too.
You know, you describe the research process and all of the ways that, you know, you sort of were able to create the world around her with letters from people who knew her and interviews with, you know, and the other side of her correspondence. And I'm just curious as to whether you have a question you would like to ask her, if you could.
To ask Dorothy Parker. Gosh, that's an amazing question. And I've never been asked it before. I guess one thing that frustrated me about her was why she was so hard on herself. I mean, she never gave herself a break. And I know that this is a gendered issue. And I know that women especially are like this because we're trying to operate in a patriarchal society. So, of course, it's much more difficult. And we seem to somehow often turn that inwards. But I would like to know why she never seemed to appreciate just how brilliant a writer she was, and how across so many genres she could write. You know, it wasn't just that she wrote really great verse or fabulous short stories. She could write films, and she could write political essays, and you know, and I think that I would like to ask her, why didn't you give yourself more credit?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because she every success she had, she seemed to come up with a reason why it wasn't really legitimate or it wasn't as good as someone else's, and she just had that really negative view of herself for all her life.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have a couple of audience questions that we can dig into, unless if there's anything else that we haven't talked about that you wanted to bring up.
No, I'm happy to, yeah, happy to answer some questions.
Fantastic. So I wanted to, there's a question from I'm sorry, I'm going to mispronounce this, from Holm, I believe. What book of hers would you recommend for someone who's not really familiar with her work? Where should they start?
I think The Portable Dorothy Parker is a great start to Dorothy Parker because it has a whole range of her writing in there. So you get verse, you get essays, you get short stories, and then right at the back, there are some letters, you know, some of the few surviving letters. So it's a really great introduction to her work, and you know, a real sort of holistic way of looking at her. So I would go with that. But I'd also just like to say that there's a new collection out which came out just after my book called The Constant Reader, which is a collection of the reviews that she wrote for The New Yorker, and that's edited by Sloane Crosley. And that is also a great, because that's Parker's early work. And so I think that her reviews are very often absolutely hilarious. And so I think it's also a great starting point too. And some of her earlier work as well. So then you can, if you wanted to read chronologically, you can move on from that.
An anonymous question who wants to know about the archives of Dorothy's original writing. I know you said earlier that her anything that would have been in her apartment was thrown out after her death, and because she moved so many times, it was difficult to, you know, it's not like she lived in the same house for years and had boxes of writing everywhere, but did original drafts or manuscripts wind up anywhere?
If they did, I didn't find them, which is what's really kind of spectacularly bizarre about a writer like Parker, who has
Yeah.
such a little paper trail. I suspect that there would have been film scripts, but of course, they're probably in the mix somewhere, maybe in the Academy Museum, places like that. They definitely won't have Parker's name on them. Or Alan Campbell's. So, you know, there may be some manuscripts somewhere, but I don't know how it would be possible to identify them. But I'm sure that there are some. Again, I uncovered one or two bits of paper here and there. As I mentioned earlier, the letter to Robert Benchley. But again, you know, that was it. And I would say as well that it in terms of her archive, it's not just her professional life that is so sparse. It's her personal life too. The only thing I think that she took with her when she finally, for the last time, moved from Hollywood back to New York was a set of soldiers that she'd bought in a market in Santa Monica. And for some reason, she was very attached to this set of soldiers. And in one of the last photographs that's taken of Parker, you can see them behind her on the shelf. And she very much hung on to those. But I believe maybe, I think one of her fur coats survived. I think maybe one of her watches survived too. But in terms of just her personal possessions, again, there's no archive for her personal possessions because there doesn't seem to be any. And if you think about, I think in recent years, there's been a real upsurge in writers and their archives, particularly the sale of their archives. You know, recently, Joan Didion's archive was sold mainly to Smith College, and there's been quite a few sales of Sylvia Plath and And then if you think about other people in Hollywood, like Marilyn Monroe, you know, all of their personal possessions have gone up in these huge auctions that have raised millions of dollars. But Parker, I guess, a set of soldiers, you know, and I don't know where they ended up. Hopefully not in the trash, but I don't know.
Hopefully they'll turn up. Yeah.
That would be very exciting.
A couple of questions specifically about your writing of this book was one from an anonymous attendee. Was Dorothy Parker well known outside of the US?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I always regarded Parker as a very global writer, really. And I think especially given that she'd had a Hollywood film made about her life as well, you know, and Mrs. Parker in the Vicious Circle, I think makes her kind of, you know, suggests what her reputation was globally. But also I think she features quite a lot in popular culture too. So she, you know, she pops up. I wrote in the introduction of the book all the places in which she popped up, you know, somebody played her in RuPaul's Drag Race. She appeared in the film Girl Interrupted. You know, Angelina Jolie read out her poem, and I think she's referenced in an episode of Desperate Housewives as well. So, you know, she's there with the big hitters, with the big guns. So, yeah, I mean, certainly, I think people would do definitely know who Dorothy Parker is in the UK. And beyond that, it will be interesting. It will be interesting to see if my book sells well in other countries. Certainly, I've had requests from France and places like that. So the book's been reviewed in France. So there's certainly, you know, interest in her in other European countries too. But that might be a question I might have to get back to you on when maybe when foreign rights come in or something.
It might be too soon to answer that one. We have a question here from Mark specifically about the publishing process and for a nonfiction book, how difficult was it to get this project approved and moved forward and published for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think my first book with Gallery Books, Simon and Schuster, was Three Martini Afternoons at the Ritz, which was the book about Plath and Sexton. And I really loved working with my editor, and I loved the entire team at Simon and Schuster and Gallery. And I'd been with my agent for quite a while, but I loved the whole process of writing that book. It was just wonderful. And I think the one thing that as a writer, if there are any other writers listening, one of the terrifying things I think is if you get a scary editor or something like that, you know, I mean, it's quite terrifying submitting your work to someone and it's going to come back at you and you're going to think, do they like it? You know, what do they think of it? And my editor, Alison Callan, is absolutely wonderful. She is the dream editor because she is so precise, and but she is very, very kind as well. And so when I'd written Three Martinis, I desperately wanted to do another book with her. And so it was really about finding a project that Alison wanted to work on again. And the first book that I'd proposed to her, she wasn't really too sure about. And so my agent and I, Carrie, thought about, well, Dorothy Parker in Hollywood, you know, is something that nobody's really written about. And also the last full biography of Parker was Marion Means, and that was over 30 years ago. So I know there's this big debate that goes on is, well, if there's already a biography, should there be another? But absolutely, there can never be enough books about anyone, you know, that and constantly refreshing that legacy seems to me for writers to be absolutely crucial because things move on and new things come to light and also attitudes change as well. And so the process of getting the book accepted and going through all of that was mainly about choosing a subject that we all wanted to work on again. And because I'm very, very lucky that Carrie, Alison, and myself have very similar interests, we all wear black all the time, and we like gothic stuff. So when we found this project, we were very, very excited, and it was wonderful to work with them all again. And I'm very pleased to say that I'll be working with them again in the future. So that's great.
Oh, wonderful. What's your next subject?
I'll be doing two more books. But one which I can talk about is going to be a shift. So it's going to be a biography of a novel, not a person. So I will be writing a biography of Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier,
Oh,
and
wonderful.
which will not just be about how that novel came about, but what happened when Rebecca went into the world at large. And so I'll be back in Hollywood. I'll be looking at Hitchcock. I'll be looking at Orson Welles, the huge scandalous plagiarism trial. And then looking, and I'll be tying it into why the lasting fascination of Rebecca, and I'll be tying that into the Me Too movement as well.
I think we have time for one more question, and I want to end on one. I want to end on one from Jane, who wants to know, what were some of Dorothy Parker's great lines in the movies? What are some, some parts of some things that she wrote that stand out to you?
Well, this is a really great question because we don't actually know for sure which lines Parker wrote. Okay, so we know which films she wrote, but because she always was working with other writers, we can never be 100% sure which lines we should credit to Parker alone. But I think that when you look at some of her scripts, you can get, and this is a lot of fun because you could think, right, where are the Parkerisms in here? Where are they? And I think my very favorite is, and again, I don't know if it's a Parker line, I'm guessing, is from The Little Foxes, where there are the two younger characters in The Little Foxes, and the young man says to the young woman, "Do you like me today?" And she says no. And he says, "Okay, I'll come back tomorrow." Pure Parker.
That's perfect. Well, we like her today. We always like her. And we like learning more about her, which I think is the really valuable part of what you've done. So thank you so much for joining us to talk about the book. And thank you to everyone who's joined us online.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for everyone coming, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you're ever in the US, please stop by the American Writers
Oh,
Museum.
for sure.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.